This is Wisconsin Public Radio on NPR One.
Veteran singer and songwriter Loudon Wainwright III is coming to Wisconsin this week, playing Thursday in Stoughton and Friday in Oshkosh. Wainwright is noted for the variety of his material, some topical music, some sad songs, and many hilarious moments. He's also acted in movies, on TV, and made the rounds of NPR programs from Fresh Air to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Wainwright is touring to bring attention to his new album called Years in the Making, which is just that, a collection drawn from close to 50 years of rare and sometimes unused material. WPR's Melissa Ingalls recently spoke with Wainwright about the making of his new album.
I work from time to time with a friend of mine here in New York City called Dick Kinnett. We did a record a while back called High, Wide, and Handsome, and another one called Older Than My Old Man Now. So we're friends and colleagues, and we were just talking about, I had been listening to some old cassette tapes or something, and then I kind of delved into that. You know, I have a kind of thing in my house it's a kind of little bunker or man cave where all my crap is. Over the last almost 50 years, I've stored up a lot of sonic materials, cassettes and hard drives and reel-to-reel tapes, and I just started listening to some of it. And basically what happened is Dick and I would bring stuff into him and we would listen together. And we kind of whittled it all down to what we thought was, for us anyway, the most interesting stuff, and that's really how it all came about.
As you were deciding on material for the album, did you have any kind of I'll be darned moments, like that were better or worse than you expected? Why did these songs that you picked out speak to you now?
I guess as far as the I'll be darned thing, I mean, there were some surprises. There were some things that I'd forgotten about and things that I couldn't figure out why the heck that song or that performance didn't go on a record ever before. A while back, somebody sent me bootlegs that people had done of me, and I hadn't really listened to that carefully enough. So there were nice little surprises throughout the process.
You're okay with the bootlegs?
I'm not really, but in a way, I don't like the idea that people come to the show and record them, and I don't know about it. And then share it, as they say. But on the other hand, there was some good stuff that I hadn't heard, and so I kind of took advantage of their misbehavior, the bootleggers' misbehavior. And for instance, talk about these bootleggers. I mean, there's a song called "Thank You, Mr. Hubble," but clearly the guy's tape recorder is in his lap. I mean, you can hear him laughing louder than anybody else. And that's an example of how sonically the record is kind of all over the place. You know, it's not a clean, pristine, perfect kind of sound, uniform sound. I mean, it jumps up, jumps around a little bit. And both Dick and I felt that was kind of compelling in a way, that the listener might become even more engaged. It's just so much variety in the different tracks.
Well, and that does bring up the issue that there is so much technology in recording now, and pitch correction technology, and the ability to basically perfect everything. What holds up for you about being a guy with a guitar in a room full of people?
Well, this has been my job for 50 years. You know, to just I have on occasion had bands, and there's some examples of that on Years in the Making. But primarily, it's been just me and my guitar. You know, aside from the fact that I like the idea that there's a little or no overhead. You know, I don't have to pay a bass player and a roadie or something. I also find for the audience to see one person standing up there on stage putting forth the songs or the show or whatever. It's just something really simple about it, which is not to say that, you know, bands aren't great and the duos aren't great and trios, but I think one person is kind of cool.
You've not only been a musician, but you've done movies, TV, the TV show MASH, written a book, you know, started out on vinyl, gone to CDs. Now we're in the download era. Do you ever feel like any one of those, you know, since you have been able to do so many different projects in that way, have you ever had moments where you think, you know, maybe I should have tried, say, movies more than music? Or, I mean, do any of those call to you in a certain way, or is music kind of, you feel like that's your kind of central home?
Well, yeah, primarily it's the way that I've earned my living. And I have, as you say, I studied to be an actor, and I thought I was going to be a kind of full-time actor, which is, that's a tough job, unless you're a movie star or something. So, but I dabble in those black arts. Occasionally somebody will have me, as you say, in a movie or a TV show. I don't have any regrets about not, you know, killing myself trying to be an act, you know, get more acting work. I've recently done something which requires acting work and also incorporates my songs and my music. I have this theater show that I've been performing called Surviving Twin. I started developing it in 2003, and I've done it in London and New York a few times, in Los Angeles and outside of Philadelphia. And it was filmed in May by Netflix. And that is an example of me doing the music, but also I put down the guitar and I perform some of the writing of my father, who was a very well-known journalist, Loudon Wainwright, also called, who wrote for Life magazine in the 1960s and 70s. So that's a kind of hybrid of acting and music that's coming out on November 13th on Netflix.
The New York Times recently ran an article where you talked about protest songs, which it was, you know, obviously pretty timely headed into the midterms. You're going to be here in Wisconsin literally a few days before the midterms. And there's a quote in there that I'd like to read to you. Throughout my career, I have come up with musical harangues, broadsides, laments, parodies, and political pot shots, and my forays into folk agitprop tend to be laced with humor in hopes of encouraging members of the audience to laugh at those they might fear and oppose. So, in your opinion, how does the laughter help? Why is that important to you?
I mean, I don't think of myself particularly as a novelty songwriter, but I have written many, many novelty songs. I still enjoy doing that. I think getting a room full of 300 people or 3,000 people or three people, for that matter, getting them laughing disarms them in a way. You know, if something is funny to you, you can't resist it. Metaphorically cross your arms, so to speak, and block it out. It disarms you. So, humor is powerful, you know, and I mentioned in that article for the New York Times, I mentioned one of my top 10 picks with Tom Lehrer, who is still alive, although he's not active, but his songs were terrifically funny and also thoughtful and great, and he's a hero of mine.